Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. Today's program will be another in my Health Challenges series. My guest is Mark T. Vallalee. Vallalee has an associate's degree in natural resources from the Finger Lakes Community College. He has been a counselor for youthful offenders and for over 20 years has worked in the water business, producing higher yield wells at various water treatment plants in Tompkins County. In 1972, at the age of 14, he got onto a scary road of drinking, drugs, bleak days, and serious mishaps until he eventually found a road to recovery. We'll discuss his long journey of addiction and recovery on today's program. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I really appreciate you talking about this subject. Now, you say you first started drinking in 1972 at the age of 14. How were you introduced to this, and what do you think motivated you to become such a heavy drinker at such a young age?
Well, I think the stage was a bit set. I had two wonderful parents. My father was a drinker, pretty heavy. So by the time I was 14, I was very shy, and there were a lot of things that happened at home that was confusing to me. But at 14, I was with some other kids that, ironically, my father did not want me hanging around with because he thought they were a bad influence. But they managed to get a fifth of whiskey, and we drove up to a little town called Middlesex, New York. And that was the first time I felt the full effects of alcohol. I had probably had a few sips of beer along the way up until that point. But that day, I had really dropped all my inhibitions and was suddenly very carefree, didn't care about the people that I didn't know in the room, and actually got my first kiss from a girl. So I was off and running, as they say. And that was sort of the effect that I was chasing after that.
Wow, that's amazing. So that first feeling of being high was kind of what hooked you.
Oh, it was glorious. Yeah, at the time it was just an absolutely wonderful feeling, and I just couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah. So how did you proceed from there, though? I mean, did you sneak out of the house? Did you have friends where you'd go meet and people would have adults buy the booze? How did you navigate that?
I think, you know, this is back in the 70s. It was probably pretty typical. Went to parties where there was booze and people were smoking marijuana. And I was just starting to get into that a little bit. Again, I was just really enjoying the feelings that it was giving me. And so, you know, through that period, through high school, I didn't seem like it was affecting me as far as grades or sports. I was very active in sports, but occasionally maybe once a month it started out, and then maybe twice a month on weekends, like a lot of the kids at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
But something I think in a lot of alcoholics and addicts, I think something starts to get triggered, and I just became more and more wanting to chase that feeling, like I said.
Yeah, and you said you eventually, like you said, you start smoking pot too. And it says that it gave you a feeling of belonging to be part of these groups of kids that were drinking and smoking.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we had a pretty good high school basketball team, and I remember walking into this one party. I had not yet smoked pot, and there was a couple of the guys from the basketball team that were passing the joint. And as is typical with a lot of people at that age, I didn't want to be the odd person there. So I inhaled and didn't feel really the effects of pot the first time because I was probably so inebriated with alcohol, but eventually started to feel the pot. And then there was times where I was just smoking pot if I couldn't get beer, and really liked that feeling just as well, that sort of a mellow, don't really care, all my troubles were gone,
yeah,
sort of feeling.
Yeah, that's what alcohol and drugs do for a lot of people. Did your family notice any change in you? Do you remember if anybody was trying to intervene, or your siblings? You're the oldest of three.
Right.
Anything about, you know, Mark, you're acting weird.
No, I don't remember that. I think, you know, like I said, because my father was a drinker, and he probably expected some of that from his oldest son, who was a wrestler and, you know, on the track team and stuff like that. And so I think he gave me some latitude to, in fact, well, one time I do remember, it was a Saturday morning. I had been out with his car the night before, his truck, and we were loading it up for the dump with garbage. And all of a sudden, he just came into the house and he said, "Somebody's been smoking pot in my truck and I don't appreciate it."
Uh-huh.
And that's all it was said. And I was like, sort of stopped me in my tracks, but he didn't want to pursue it. probably partly because of his issues with drinking.
Yeah.
But he let it be known that he didn't appreciate marijuana, but that really didn't
have
much of an effect.
Wow, too bad. You almost got caught.
Yeah.
Now, you say in 1976 your family moved from New York State to Hawaii, and your drinking increased. You got into LSD, speed, mushrooms.
Oh, yeah.
This is amazing. So you actually went on a real career of druggy
yes.
world
yeah.
from the age of, you know, of 14.
Yeah. So when I was 17, we moved from Little Interlake in New York to Honolulu, Hawaii, and it was just a radically different culture, different flora, fauna, everything
yeah.
was completely different. I was the new person, you know, and very out of sorts with my surroundings. And I talked some street guy into buying a six-pack. I had the money. He had the ID, and so he bought a six-pack. We split it. Was down at the beach drinking and realized, like, what am I doing down here? All the action's back on Waikiki. So there I was with a brown paper bag thinking, I don't know anybody here, so who cares? And then I look up, and the bus going by was my father standing there.
Oh, my God.
And so I chased that bus down for, like, three blocks trying to explain to him that it wasn't really what it looked like, which is absolutely what it was, his
yeah.
son drinking out of a brown paper bag. But yeah, things really took off there. The people I met right away or gravitated to were people that eventually did drugs like I did, drank like I did. So those are the people that I was just naturally wanting to be around.
Yeah.
And it did. It really took off, and they introduced me to speed. Marijuana was totally different. You know, we would roll these great big fat joints here in New York. Out there, they rolled this little tiny pinner joints, and I thought, well, these guys don't know how to roll joints.
Yeah, and it was much more potent.
Oh,
I'm
yeah,
sure.
Two hits, and I was hallucinating. It was
wow,
yeah.
God, that's so amazing. So, you know, eventually you went in the late 70s and joined the Navy, and your drinking increased, and you had a freak accident in 1978, fell three stories at a barracks, and ended up being kicked out of the Navy, essentially, right?
Right. Yeah, one of the things that happened when I joined the Navy was one of my first duty stations. I remember going into the laundromat and looking around. They had pool tables and pinball machines and a beer machine. And I thought, I remember consciously thinking I made the right decision.
Mm.
I was at a place that drank, that, you know, guys drank
almost
hard.
Encouraged it, right?
Yes, partied yeah. hard, drank hard. And so that really accelerated. And, yeah, one night we had been arrested for destruction of a bathroom after just drinking all day long from a shop party. And I got it in my head. I was going to try this. I was going to climb over this railing and swing out and swing back into the second-story railing, the kind of stuff that you see on TV. And as soon as I swung out, I slipped and went all the way to the bottom.
God, you were lucky you didn't get killed.
Yeah, yeah. So I broke my jaw several places, almost bit my tongue off. They had to restitch my tongue, gums. I'd lost a bunch of teeth.
Oh, my God.
And the doctor said, he said, you know, you're lucky you were as drunk as you were because you kind of landed like a sack of potatoes.
Yeah, you're more relaxed.
And I remember looking at him thinking, Doc, if I hadn't been drinking, I probably wouldn't have done the stupid stunt in the first place.
Yeah, but you understood his sentiment, right?
Oh, yeah.
When you're drunk, you're more limp.
Right,
and
yeah.
Not as
yeah.
prone to being all stiff. And
yeah.
Oh, God. So what finally turned you around? You say in 1980 you tried to stop drinking and doing drugs several times. What finally pushed you over the edge to make you even try?
Yeah, I think slowly I was realizing that I was out of control. Many, many days I had thought that today has to be different. I can't keep drinking like this. And I would have all this conviction during the work day that, tonight it's going to be different. I'm going to go home. I'm going to read a book. I'm going to do something constructive around the house. And we had these old mechanical time clocks. And I would punch that clock, and it was a real mechanical funk. And it was just like Pavlov's dog. As soon as I heard that, I would start to salivate and I would just be wanting to go get drunk. And, like, all that conviction went right out the window. And so I thought I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
I remember sharing with a friend about this, and I said, I really think I might be going crazy because I can't seem to stop. You know, the cocaine was getting really bad. Just any kind of – actually, it didn't even matter. Whatever somebody put in my hands, I was ingesting if they said I could get
high. So you were feeling the real psychological and physical addiction probably at this point,
right? Oh, yeah,
right?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely physically addicted to it, to everything, to the booze and the coke and the pot probably. But
So what did you finally do? Because you knew you couldn't do it by yourself. So you ended up finding a recovery.
Yeah, just before recovery, there was what they call oftentimes in the recovery community a moment of clarity. This was actually, and I remember it, December 24th, 1980, 2 days before I really reached out for some help. And I was sitting in front of my drug dealer's house, and it was Christmas Eve, and I could hear all the music, and the lights were blinking. And I thought back to when life was a magical time when I was a kid. You know, despite my father's drinking, he was a big kid, and Christmas and birthdays were just magical at my house. And I was thinking back to, like, those fun times, and now here I was sure I was going to die soon. And the saddest thing to me at the time was I didn't care. I just didn't care anymore. And so 2 days later, or 3 days later, December 27th, I had called the bank. A car of mine had been repossessed because I was in an accident due to drinking. And I just thought that was the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, that by itself wasn't a real big deal, but it was just a constant series of bad accidents and events. And I thought my life was over.
Yeah.
And,
so you know, like what everybody talks about, hitting bottom.
Yeah, definitely.
You finally did hit bottom. Yeah,
that was my first bottom. And so I reached out and made a phone call to one of the local 12-step programs and went to a meeting that night. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't want to stop drinking.
Yeah.
I thought they would help me control my drinking learn how to drink properly.
We've heard that story before, haven't we?
Yeah. And I didn't know what I was getting into. And so I sat by the door, the closest seat to the door in case it didn't work out. But at some point I stood up and I said my name, and this was my first meeting. And then I sat down quickly and realized that now they all know. You know, that was stupid.
But so you didn't feel any kind of relief. You felt like sort of embarrassed.
I was confused. I was torn. I was angry. I was scared.
Were you sober?
Yeah, I hadn't drank that well. I had been partying the night before.
Uh-huh.
That day, I left work and went to this meeting. And so sober was a relative term that first day.
Yeah.
You know, my body was still probably full of all kinds of drugs. But
that was the turning point for you.
Yes.
You realized that you were going to die if you didn't do this.
Yeah.
And so you found a community that actually was able to help you.
Right.
But it all has to come from you, right? I mean, no matter
yes.
who you surround yourself with.
Yes.
You have to want this to happen, right?
That's key. That's actually a good point. That's, there's a lot of help out there. There's a huge recovery community, and it's all really designed for people who want it, not for people who need it, because there's a lot of people that need it and will never get it, sadly. And, you know, I've watched a lot of people come in and out, and I've been one of the fortunate ones so far.
If you're just joining us, this is another of my Health Challenges series. I'm talking to Mark Vallalee about his addiction and recovery process. Now, you say after that first meeting when you decided that you really needed to get help, you only stayed sober for 6 months.
Right.
So what happened?
I was doing a lot of the right things. I had a what we call a sponsor, and I was working on these 12 steps that I was learning about, trying to take responsibility for my own action. I think a lot of what I'd spent my life doing was blaming others, having all kinds of excuses for why my behavior was so erratic. And I had to really get to a point where to take a hard, hard look at myself and think about where I was at fault with things. And that's a difficult process. I mean, most of us don't want to look at our shortcomings and whatnot.
And then people run away and say, I don't have a problem, and they get really angry sometimes.
Right. I used to storm out of some of these meetings angry because somebody would say something that probably hit a nerve with me. It probably was some bit of truth that I didn't want to hear. Yeah. And I would storm out, and my first sponsor would say, like, you know, maybe you should just stay for the whole meeting. Make that kind of a goal. And so that was hard. And, you know, there was a lot of hard things in the beginning. It was very difficult.
You know, considering, Mark, that there's so much psychological baggage that a lot of people who drink and do drugs and can't control it have, do people need to go to a therapist, do you think, in addition to sponsors are not necessarily professionals in the psychological community, obviously. So do you think a lot of people would need to go through that therapy and just go through the whole process of why did this happen, what's gone on in my life?
That's a great question. I don't know, because there's a lot of different pathways to recovery. Mm. And I guess those of us that have been successful have found different paths. When I came in, rehabs weren't real big at the time. And there was a lot of what they call tough love. You know, you'd go to somebody's house and we would, you know, read different types of material, maybe work on the steps, you know, try to get involved in your local meetings and stuff like that, you know, stay involved. And the other thing was to, you know, try to stay away from the old crowd, you know, because towards the end of my drinking and drugging, the fact is I was doing things I didn't want to be doing. I was hanging out with people I didn't want to be with, and I was in places I didn't want to be. And so this new life was very hard to develop these new friendships with people that were in the recovery. And that was my setbacks, was I just kept hanging around with the old crowd. I used to ride with a biker club out there in Hawaii, and I would go to sometimes after meetings on a Friday night. You know, some people would go out for cake and coffee, and I'm like, oh, really? We're going to do that again? You know, it's like I was used to the wild ones, you know. And so I'd go to these other guys' house where they're passing the cocaine mirror and the joints and the kegs in the back, and I'm trying to smoke my cigarettes with a bottle of Coca-Cola, and it just wasn't working.
No, I'm sure it wouldn't work.
Yeah, you know? And eventually it caught up with me. And you know, when you have been exposed to recovery and now you're inebriated, that's an awful place to be.
Oh, I can imagine.
Because now you know there's a different way.
You know what I want to bring up, too, because a lot of people think in terms of rehab is this period of time where you're going to go get sober. We hear about Hollywood people doing it all the time and then they come back out. And so this takes a day by day. Real, you know, I mean, you have to have a real conviction to be able to stay sober, right?
Right.
You can't just go on a 6-week rehab at the Betty Ford Center, come out and start your life again and think it's just going to take.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think probably a lot of the rehabs are fine to give you a sort of a kickstart into recovery. Mm. But you don't, it's not necessary. Like I said, there's a lot of us that didn't go into rehab. But you had to really get a hold of this idea that just for today, I'm not going to pick up that first one, that first joint, that first line on the mirror, that first drink, and not worry about the rest of my life. You know, not worry about, you know, because there's times I'd love to take a mental, emotional vacation.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I just don't. I don't have the equipment for that. You know, that was, I'm powerless over the stuff. There's nothing I think it's genetics, a big part of it.
Yeah.
And so I do have some options on trying to overcome this problem.
Yeah. You talk about how exercise and being involved in physical activity and running and stuff has helped you a lot. Talk to us about how important that was. It must alleviate some of the stress, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but when I first quit drinking and drugging, I had an amazing amount of time on my hands. You know, because there was that whole point between getting out of work And by the time my head would hit the pillow, where I was just full of drinking and drugging and chasing more drinking and drugging, and all of a sudden that was gone. And, you know, I could go to some of these meetings. That would take up about an hour. But my father was running marathons, and he dragged me along to the marathon clinic they used to have out in Hawaii. And I just started running. And
literally running for your life,
yeah,
it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did the Honolulu Marathon in 81 and 82. And then I joined one of the Outrigger Canoe Clubs out there. And that was a great community of people, very healthy, oriented, like-minded people. And I realized that there's other ways I can enjoy my life. I can feel the effects of sort of our natural endorphins and stuff on a regular basis.
Without the artificial means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what a great thing to discover, though. You know, a lot of I told you that I've had a lot of people on for these health challenges, and so many of them talk about how exercise has been part of the, you know, the recovery and the,
sure,
the healing process. And
yeah,
it's an amazing drug itself, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I think even more so for a lot of addicts and alcoholics, it's a place that I can sort of dwell into my compulsion a little bit and be rewarded.
Yeah,
and
it's a healthy compulsion.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And, yeah, you know, because I came back here, I started doing little baby triathlons, and then I worked my way up into doing an Ironman competition 4 times up in Lake Placid. So it's been a wonderful journey. And now I'm big into CrossFit, which is another amazing community of wonderful people. And
so I assume you would recommend that if somebody's trying to get into recovery, that they find some kind of physical activity, whether it be yoga or running or
absolutely,
whatever.
I don't care if it's birding, walking, yoga, like you said, running, just something that gives you that you can do regularly, that's healthy. And oftentimes you will be put in contact with a community of people like that. And that was one of the things that was sort of, you know, I had to leave this community of alcoholics and drug addicts. And that was hard. You know, I mean, I knew these people. I thought I knew them pretty well. I mean, they were the ones I hung out with. And suddenly I had to change that.
Those are huge steps.
Yeah.
I mean, if anybody thinks it just has to do with stopping drinking or stopping drugs,
no,
you have to change your whole life.
No, actually, it's often been said that putting the drink down is the easy part.
Yeah.
You know, changing your life is the hard part.
Yeah, and building a new community as an adult, and
right,
often an older adult, is a tough one.
Yeah.
Now, I even heard this recently, but what do you say to people who say addiction is a choice? It's, you know, I don't feel sorry for these people. They don't really have a disease. I saw that recently on Facebook. Somebody was saying that about somebody.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to people? I mean, I personally think it is a disease.
Yeah, I do too. It's funny. I've gone through quite a range of emotions around this. You know, in the beginning, I think I was more adamant about that they need to see it my way. You know, like it is a disease. You know, and it's like, and part of it is fear. There's a little bit of fear, like, well, what if they were right? You know. Now I've gotten to the point where I'm much more comfortable with where I'm at. I'm much more comfortable with my journey. I'm much more comfortable with the fact that I am absolutely powerless over alcohol and drugs, and I'm not going to change that. And so once in a while, I'll notice sometimes where this is coming from, some of the people. They may have some issues themselves, not always, but
People who think it's a choice and
yeah,
you just, you know,
that,
get over it kind of thing.
If I was drinking, back in my drinking day, I remember somebody told me, they saw this guy, he says, oh, there's Jim, you know, he used to party like a wild man, but he doesn't do it anymore, you know, he just quit. And I remember thought, like, well, Jim must be, like, cuckoo now. Yeah, he must be a nut. It's like, I don't want anything to do with him. I don't want to get near him because it might be contagious.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's the other thing is there is a bit of a stigma sometimes and people don't understand it. And really, I don't want to make people, I hate it when people are uncomfortable. You know, they're sort of like falling over themselves like, oh, you don't drink? And you know, I'm happy if they're curious to answer questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they want to drink, that's fine. You know, I just know about me now.
Yeah.
I don't want to drink.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can't drink safely.
Yeah. So, I think addiction is a bit of a disease. I had an alcoholics in my family, and I knew they couldn't stop. I mean, that's not a choice,
right?
To me.
Right, yeah.
Well, what do you say to people who are discovering that drinking's getting in the way of their life right now, some young person? How do you talk to people who are just beginning this journey? What would you recommend?
Well, anytime I come across somebody that has genuine questions, one of the first things I do is I share my own experience, strength, and hope, really. I don't want to get on a soapbox and tell them what they should do or shouldn't do. But if I can share with them a little bit about how I felt, the remorse that I was feeling towards the end of my drinking, the out of control, like I felt helpless, if I could explain that to them a little bit, maybe they'll see like, geez, this guy's, he understands, And then I tell them how I had to reach out and I had to be ready for it and I had to be willing to take some of these suggestions. And I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I really didn't.
People have a hard time admitting weakness.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you find that you had to go back? I think often people recommended they go back in their lives and apologize or try to make amends with people they've hurt.
Definitely. Yeah. There's a whole process of realizing and actually writing down any people that we had wronged. Look seriously and hard at my part in it.
Mm.
And sometimes it was really hard with certain types of relationship things or, there's family issues and stuff, and to separate all those out. And so I had to, just look at my part in something and go back and do the best I could, make some sort of amends. And it's a continuous process because I still make mistakes. I still can screw up on a monumental level, even though I'm clean and sober.
Well, you're a human being.
Right,
and that's
exactly.
That's what you have to come to conclusions
exactly.
about, too.
And one of the ways to maintain my sobriety is to make sure I'm paying attention to this. If I wrong someone, because it wouldn't take much for me to say, the heck with that person, they're just an idiot, and I can start down this sort of downward spiral. And there's a saying that, our disease is back there doing push-ups, staying nice and strong. And I got to make sure my recovery is staying nice and strong.
Yeah.
I can't just because I put the drugs and the booze down, it's not over.
You have to stay ever vigilant.
Yeah, and this helps me, our steps helps me grow as a person. There's always new things I can learn. There's always try to stay humble, which is, easier said than done.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we're almost out of time. I do want to recommend that people call the Alcohol and Drug Council of Tompkins County if you want information about meetings, about getting help for any kind of addiction problem. Please go do it today. Don't waste any time. Go do it today if you feel like your life's out of control in regard to these issues. Mark Vallely, thank you so much for joining us. This was a Health Challenges. We've been talking to Mark Vallely about his addiction and recovery, and we appreciate you telling your story. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.